Welcome to the Eucatastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. Behold how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity. Well, we can't do that right now, can we? Not that Dave and I ordinarily dwell together. That would be odd. But I'm here, Joel, your host, along with my co-host, Dave Taylor. And we are, of course, socially distancing. Although I've just seen the New South Wales government says you can now, as of, I'm not sure when, you can have two people over to your house.
Yeah.
Yeah. Party times.
Yeah. Let's not.
Wow. Wow. Somebody's becoming a little too used to this electronic social distancing business.
Yeah. I mean, someone's got to look after these jars of urine I've been storing up. So.
What?
Yeah, and the Kleenex, the Kleenex box is off my on my feet.
Oh, is this your cleaning product? You're going to be injecting it soon.
Yeah.
As disinfectant. Yeah. I've got a question for you.
Yes.
We're doing our second part in our COVID-19 trilogy.
Yep.
As we consider the pandemic that is engulfing us all. And so I have a question, Dave. What is your least favorite subgenre of COVID-19 activity or commentary or whatever?
I think the commentary thing is interesting. I think I just this is surprising given what we're doing now, did last week and are going to do again. I'm just sick of everyone having a hot take on the situation. I'm so sick of jokes about introversion, like people saying, you know, I'm an introvert, so I've been raised to do this. I was like, you know, it was mildly amusing the first time, but the 600th meme that I've seen about that, that's wearing a bit thin.
I think it also just shows a persons who keep on hammering on that, it just seems to be, it's not so much introversion as you have a problem.
That's right. Yeah.
I think you're maybe not so much an introvert as just, you know, a misanthropist.
Yeah. Yeah. Or yeah, there's all sorts of things that might be going on there actually. I think there's the obvious, the hoarding activities, I suppose, early on were wearing a bit thin. But then there's also, I won't give away my main annoyance because it's related to our topic for today.
Okay, well, I'll give you a couple that aren't then, right? They do dovetail into it though. So one I think is really annoying is the academic subgenre of academics who see this as their time to shine.
Yeah, right.
So I think Chris Mays actually posted a piece on this, which was just a beautiful example of it. Someone writing on The Conversation, they're a dietitian, writing an article on the food you should be eating while you're isolating, you know, food you should be eating while you're quarantining. And you're going, oh my gosh, it's like everything in the university now has to be, you know, redirected towards our COVID-19 analysis. It's just kind of like, no, well, actually, maybe just certain people should be speaking on this and the rest of us should be trying to get on with other things that may also be important to things we do together as a society, right? So that's one thing I find incredibly annoying, just the immediate sort of appeal to your sudden expertise relating to the pandemic in obscure fields especially.
Yeah.
Another one I find really annoying is the sort of, you kind of get the advertising meets the peacock displays of my consumption acts, right? So what am I going to be doing while I'm in quarantine? Look at all the books I'll read. Look at all the shows I'll be watching and da-da-da. I just think, who are these people? Like, What do they do with their time most of it?
Sarah and I have been talking about this as well. We've seen so many posts online from people saying like, or articles going, you know, here's what to do with all your extra time during the
where
pandemic.
Is this extra time?
Who has extra time? Like I'm working more than ever because my workspace is at my dining room table.
I know. Not to mention the sheer exhaustion of it. It's like everything, this is another thing we'll be talking about how everything has become like a task.
Yeah.
Everything has become something you must do in order to maintain some sense of normality or some sense of whatever it is. Mm. And it just becomes utterly, utterly exhausting. You know, and it matches with, you know, you get, what is it? That what's that? Audiobooks, and you get their Netflix, and you get this. Constantly sending you stuff like, you know, here's what you could do with your COVID-19 time. I'm like, just leave me alone. Like, I just want to, I just want to go to bed right now. You know, that's the main thing. Anyway, so this is going to dovetail into what we're going to be discussing, because what we're looking at in this episode is, what does it mean for us that the churches are closed during this pandemic? And then what do we think about this rush to technology that we see that is engulfing the churches during the pandemic? What should we be thinking about this, and how should we be thinking as a church? I think it's right to put up front, you know, there is a sense in which this is immediately jarring to the nature of how we understand church and what it means to be Christian, even. I was looking back at Bonhoeffer's Life Together, and early in the book, he talks about the believer feeling no shame that we live in the flesh. He yearns for the physical presence of other Christians. Man was created a body, this is me quoting Bonhoeffer. The Son of God appeared on earth in the body. He was raised in the body. In the sacrament, the believer receives the Lord Christ in the body, and the resurrection of the dead will be bringing about the perfected fellowship of God's spiritual physical creatures. The believer therefore lords the Creator, the Redeemer, God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, for the bodily presence of a brother. The prisoner, the sick person, the Christian in exile, sees in the companionship of a fellow Christian a physical sign of the gracious presence of the triune God, right? We desire a connection with one another that is not just simply, you know, ephemeral and electronic, but is actually physical. You know, Augustine in the Confessions talks about even how friendship is generated not just out of, you know, say a common willing, but the gestures of the body, in which you interpret those micro gestures to build a shared love for one another. You know, so there's always this, and in the biblical, in the scriptures, of course, you get Paul praying day and night that he sees your face. The aged John writes about coming to see his own people and speak to them face to face rather than writing with ink. So there's all this thread running through about how we desire, we have this holy longing to be in the physical presence of one another. And then we have this scenario, of course, where we can't be. And, you know, not to, and we're not, I don't think either of us are critical of that. This is a point in time in which solidarity with one's neighbor, love for one's neighbor means being apart for a certain period of time. But we did, this made me then think about how last year we did an episode called Sacred Spaces, right? Or I think we called it Resisting Secular Space. We discussed how the church's very cultivation of physical space is a resistance to secularity. And yet we can't do this right now, right? So now we have this scenario where potentially what we're doing, we're meeting in what could be characterized as a non-place, as you discussed it with when we were looking at resisting secular space.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very interesting. So I am currently doing my, finishing up my prac for my counseling qualification. And I'm in a supervision group with a bunch of other students who we get clinical supervision from a lecturer at our college. And a couple of weeks ago, we all started reporting that people that we are seeing are reporting incredibly vivid dreams at the moment. And we started coming across articles that discussed this. And one of the articles that I just came across today was about how one of the explanations for people having kind of this vivid dream life at the moment is that people deprived of their usual locations and the stimulation that comes from their usual exposure to space makes a kind of psychological need to generate mental spaces in their dream life. I thought that was fascinating, especially given kind of the closure of our sacred spaces. That this seems to open up a psychic wound even. I think that's absolutely fascinating. But the point about, I mean, I think what we were, part of what we were discussing in that episode was that the church can and historically has provided a spaces of, or places, which is a space that has a historical, shared historical meaning that brings people together in a shared identity and a shared narrative kind of thing. And these spaces have been replaced over time with these non-places, which are transient, ahistorical, atemporal spaces. But part of what we were saying as well was that the church has kind of bought into that paradigm. So it's lost this sense that it's there to provide continuity and a historical instantiation of a trans-historical kind of community.
Yeah, the building itself can actually matter because it is, you know, extended horizontally across time.
Yes.
As in we are, you know, in communion with the deceased and the future, right? But also vertically appeals up to God, right? So in the very building itself, you get this evocation of or this grounding of a solidarity, right? That may combat alienation, a sense that you're removed from the place as we are from, you know, in our context of market economies or education spaces, for example.
Yes. And what kind of critics of the migration of social life onto the online space discuss is the turning of the self inwards through an abstract relations generated through online presence. And so that has the opposite of an ecclesial building in that it's almost a Luther's definition of sin is incurvatus in se, which is the man turned in on himself. And that seems to be what these kinds of mediums for communication and togetherness generate.
So that's fascinating just on that point because I've been thinking about this how, you know, there's these articles going around about why Zoom that everyone's using is exhausting.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought one thing to add to that is because Zoom places you into quite strict role occupancies.
Yes.
So you use, it's functionally designed for a boardroom meeting.
Yep.
Like that's its purpose. And so by adopting it as your platform, you are now taking your boardroom meeting role into different spheres of your life.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's at least been the point of a couple of articles that I've read about this. So I'm very interested in this topic as well about Zoom exhaustion and things like that. So I had 7 hours of Zoom in one day was my record, and that made me look into why do I feel like I want to die? part of it is that so one theory of the way in which we approach the world is through that we have kind of different personas that we put on, different masks that we wear in different aspects of life. And there's been critiques in kind of postmodern literature around that as a dehumanizing thing, but it's actually a very positive thing, right? There's a good sense in which I have a demarcation between the role that I play in a particular situation and I perform a different social function in each of those different situations. But what working remotely means is that your identity, I think, gets frayed around the edges. So you can't separate your different roles. And I think that generates a bit of exhaustion.
Yeah. Yeah, and everything becomes almost a sense of work. So this will go to one of the points I want to make about the shift to online technology with churches is that I think for some of us, using Zoom and things is associated with our work week. So the idea is that church is supposed to be an interruption from a sense of ordinary or fungible time or the time that is, you know, managed by spreadsheets and timesheets for clocking in and out
That's
of work.
Right.
And then if you're told, let's go and do a Zoom thing on a Sunday, I'm like, no, thank you. I don't want to continue with my work life.
Yeah.
I want to be drawn out of that somehow into something that is more, you know, transcendental. And so there's a real problem. Whereas I think for ministers, right, there probably a lot of the time there isn't that connection because this is their work life, right?
Yeah.
They're thinking, I've got to work.
Yeah.
So then there's a kind of movement towards Zoom and whatever. Anyway, so on the non-places, right, the quintessential example, of course, is like an airport. Mm. These are places in which people can be transient and they're fungible, as in they can, airport can look the same anywhere in the world. And so they cultivate weak ties because it's between transient persons who are migratory and so on.
They're designed specifically to move people through rather than to,
Right.
And if people pause within them, they're not doing their job.
And we were discussing this with the burning of Notre Dame and how that potentially pointed to our reaction where people were desiring these places. But our desire for place at the moment is obviously very complicated by the fact that we're living within this pandemic. And I think it's complicated like in deep ways. So people are both reconnecting with local places. Like you, for example, can't go to your gym and engage in your saturated evil, right? You now have to actually go walk around your local area. So there is this reconnection with local places that I think is important to think about for the church, because cosmopolitans can't escape, right? Yeah. They're now locked into local places. I love the fact that that the cruise ship has now become like the site of cultural revulsion, right? But then there's also this deepening dematerialization that's happening, right? We're seeing each other more on screens. We become, as we just said, more functional. So we can't linger in conversations. We have to converse simply to catch up or either to do for work. And there's this kind of enchantment that then takes place with technology, right? In which we see ourselves as somehow being... Well, you know, Max Weber would talk about it as the new gods that are sitting over and above us, the platform that sort of miraculously appears in our life and facilitates our social gatherings and so on. Anyway, so this is all interesting, I think, because now we're in a scenario in which churches are using these platforms that both maybe alienate us, but maybe also at the same time somehow necessary in the current context. My impression is that a lot of this turn to technology is just done on a basis that, you know, oh, well, it's good for facilitating stuff we already do. Mm. You know, there's no real deep analysis from at least leaders in the church around the use of this technology and how it's not morally neutral. Even talking about Zoom and how it's designed for, I think, a boardroom.
Yeah.
You know, that seems to be like its platform usage. Yeah. If you think about Facebook, for example, you know, Facebook was designed by a college dropout.
Yeah.
And it was designed
to rate women.
And it was designed with the things that a male college graduate would want to see.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, there's even I read once that it's blue because Mark Zuckerberg is colorblind and can only see it blue. Maybe that's an urban myth. Mm. But these things are designed with moral purposes in mind, right? So how are we using this? You know, what do we like what's going on? And my mind is that there are certain pathologies within some church context that could be easily intensified, while at the same time trying to recognize that maybe this is in part necessary at this time. So I probably haven't framed the context, but what we're seeing amongst churches, of course, is this movement to have entire services online, right? Entire services. In some places, this is just simply a... you know, traditional service with Eucharistic celebration. Mm. And then in the low church context, it's the movement from worship into then the heights of the sermon, right? Mm. And then you also see small groups and you see then I've had friends who are talking about how they get given basically like work programs to work their way through while they're online and so on. And things like this, like go into breakout groups in Zoom and do some intensive XYZ sort of stuff. So I have real concerns about this, but what are you thinking?
Yeah, like I share all those concerns. I mean, there's a couple of things to say there. So this situation seems to serve kind of more low church people, particularly not serve them well, but the low church seems to be better able to accommodate themselves to this because of the centrality of the message of the preacher to the life of the church, particularly the common life of the church, life together kind of thing. So if that's something that can just be delivered online.
Yeah, which should raise a real question, shouldn't it? You know, if your service is translatable because the height of your service is this 45-minute pseudo-lecture.
Yeah.
Right? Now, I think having a homily or sermon in the context of a local congregation is a good thing when it's part of a movement of the whole church, right?
Yeah.
And it's part of a movement through prayer and so on. But like if you have an emphasis on this 45-minute thing as the height, right, and you can just simply present it, you know, with very little loss in an online environment, then surely that poses a question about how you're doing church.
Yeah. So if we go back to the idea that Zoom is designed for boardroom meetings, like why is that the case? How does Zoom allow that to happen? And I guess it's because boardroom meetings are there for the delivery of information the sharing of information between different people. What it's missing is a concern for the bodily kind of communication, the all the micro gestures and things like that that go along with forming deep social bonds with people. That human beings are kind of set up in such a way that we are constantly searching for communication within the body language of other people. But if all the purpose of the gathering is to
impart
information between parties, then Zoom is fine. But, and that's, by the way, that is why we often feel, part of the reason we feel exhausted is that our mind is, our brains are searching for communication that can't, that it can't get. We're searching for body language, we're searching for facial expression, and that's all frustrated, and that's why we feel
okay, tired. So this can then go into what is, when I have a slightly darker thought, right? And that if it is just this focus on, that's you see that as the heights, and then you're using this as a means to impart information to a group of people, right? One of my concerns is that this heightens then another pathology that we see in some context, namely this sort of strong, charismatic man who is now presenting themselves as a online presence that is teleported into my very into my very home, right? You know, to the point that you set up your own YouTube channels or you set up your own whatever channels and you set up a this, and it becomes like this. It's not just now I'm serving the local congregation, although that certainly is a case, but it's also an exercise in branding, what we would call in the university, you know, talking about impact. You know, we always have to have these impact measures about who's been listening to me on what platforms, you know, to the point that, you know, one of the lovely stories, one of the stories I love about John Milbank that he told me was he got the award from the University of Nottingham for the most retweeted academic. Which you can see why if you follow his Twitter account. But, you know, this is a thing that universities do, right? This development of this sort of personality culture. And the same thing happens in a church context, right? So now we have people creating brands.
That's right.
And then you have the scenario, of course, where because it's all online, these brands can compete with one another for their market share. We do that anyway because we've lost a sense of what it is to be the parish, right? The parish is in this geographical space, but it's rather, you know, where do I want to go to take my version of Christianity or whatever? Now you've got it even more heightened because you can just tune in to wherever you want to tune in.
Yeah, that's right. And you even see people on social media talking about that they kind of cherry pick the facets of church life that they want during this time. So they'll kind of go to such and such as sermons, and then they'll go to this parish's kind of group discussions, and then and so on and so forth.
Which is, you know, maybe you're one church, you can think of it that way, but then you get these scenario, you get this discussion then comes up about church growth, as though I saw one comment being said about that more than three times the number of people that could fit into the cathedral tuned into the service. You know, and that's like, I mean, in these circumstances, you can think we find some good where you can, but that strikes me as really problematic. You know, I know from giving online lectures, right, the capacity for people to tune in and stay for a whole period of time, for starters. So you can't really align that with somebody being physically present. But it also seems to buy into this mentality that the entire point is to have numbers, growth.
Yes. So there's that. I mean, I guess I'd want to push back slightly there and say, there is a sense, and perhaps we'll talk about this next week, but there is a sense in which this is a great opportunity, like that people who are either lapsed Christians or are just kind of curious are feeling a deep spiritual yearning for all the issues that we've been discussing, and I think are kind of checking out online spaces and things like that. I was talking to a Roman Catholic friend recently, who was talking about the huge numbers that, comparatively huge, considering contemporary Catholic church attendance in Australia, huge amount of attendance in Catholic parishes. And it's people who, because of different reasons and different perhaps even disciplinary measures within the church feel like they're able to kind of partially participate in church life in a way that they'd either denied themselves or had been denied to them in the past. And I think there's something perhaps positive to build on there.
And right. Maybe that's right. And maybe, you know, I should bear that in mind. And also, but can I complicate it a little bit and just speculate as well that maybe people are also in this current context pre-reflexively or however they're doing it, reflectively or however, thinking about how they desire actual places.
Yeah.
They want to be part of a community. They want to feel that they're not, you know, simply a isolated monad in a house. And so, you know, you see around us where we live, the total lack of social distancing in our local park is phenomenal, right? It's just a swarm of people that have gone to this area because they have this sort of nominal license to do so. And I wonder, for example, you know, Grace Davey, this sociologist, talks about how churches provide social infrastructure. She talks about this in two ways. One is that they provide the context for a debate that society itself won't have.
Yep.
So often it is the center of a debate that society itself is struggling to work through, but the church is the venue in which it happens.
Yep.
And then she secondly says it provides actual social infrastructure in which, you know, in times of crisis and in times of real need, it's the church that is turned to. So in times when there's a national disaster or tragedy, you know, you saw, for example, the firefighters who died during the latest bushfire catastrophe.
Yeah.
You know, the services were held in churches and leaders of the nation and state and so on attend, right? So there's a sense in which the church is there for the people. And we talked about this in the context of, you know, resisting secular space, is that the church is there to, as a sort of, as a place to maintain a concern for the common good.
Mm.
And so, you know, those people are going there, they may also be sitting there, they may also be looking at this with a sense of longing, right?
Yeah.
That they are wanting to be part of these places. And I think that's something that we need to think about, you know, after, I say after this crisis, but, you know, after looks, who knows what after is. But anyway, the idea that actually people do probably want, you know, that locality, that sense of community, that potentially even the sense of festiveness that you kind of see at the moment in our local parks when you've got people just doing quite a lot of activity and a kind of sort of distance from each other, but also a kind of strange communality going on as well.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that that makes sense, right? So after huge global or national tragedies, you do see a spike in church attendance. And I think there's a couple of explanations of that that are probably interrelated. One is that people become conscious of their mortality and their contingency. And so they're looking for some sort of spiritual comfort. But another thing is that our society has organized itself and its spaces in particular in such a way that people are alienated from one another. And the way in which humans are kind of put together to deal with crises and traumas and things like that is to come together in shared space and to share perspectives and experiences of a collective trauma. And that's how we kind of go through a healing process. But we've robbed ourselves of the social resources necessary to do for that process of grieving, processing trauma and things like that. And so people are drawn to the last kind of vestiges, one of the last vestiges of this, what I'd call kind of spaces of common sense of reality. They kind of drift towards churches. And it's interesting that the role that I think Anzac Day played recently in this kind of global situation, because I don't know, maybe you'd have to kind of look at the figures for this, but there seemed to be a much deeper and more profound interest in Anzac Day than usually happens this year, because precisely people were kind of had lost this regular feature of the national life that perhaps they didn't even participate in, that is like the dawn services and the marches and things like that. But nonetheless, they liked the idea that it was going on without them, even when they weren't attending. And so what people did in response in Sydney, at least, I think this was a national thing, people started doing a dawn kind of gathering in their driveways to kind of just stand in solidarity. And so, and I don't think that that was just about commemorating victims of war. I think that was actually part of our coping with the situation that we all find ourselves in. It was an excuse to come together and see each other and share this sense of, wow, this is a really messed up situation that we're in, and it filled a deep psychological need in us.
Oh, I think that happens at the park. You know, you see the little breakout conversations, and it's just like this total and utter cathartic need for some kind of relationship. But we're going to go over because I want us to. There's one other thing I wanted to sort of raise. I think then dovetails into you know, what should be happening, which I don't have much on what should be. I mean, I have largely concerns, right? But one thing I find so perplexing about this is that as soon as we were moving towards forms of isolation and distancing and so on, we just saw this absolute outpouring of frenetic activity. Mm. You know, in the university, for example, where you'd think that there'd be this sense of going, well, actually, now we've got all these additional pressures on us. We have to stop and think what we're doing and what can we target? No, it was like a ramping up of the usual stuff around outputs, around outcomes, all the various things and all the activity that we had to do to both get online, but then also to maintain a certain sense of the normality, right? In which the normality may be have real problems with it. But then the same thing has happened, I think, in the church context, right? There's a sense in which, I said it before, you know, ministers may think that they have to be doing something in order to be showing that they're active.
Yep.
That, you know, people have almost like justifying their wages and their offerings, you know, this sort of thing. And I think that, and if you're a parishioner who thinks in those ways, then you probably need to stop, right? Because actually this total rush to frenetic activity to make sure we're always doing something, you know, whether it's various groups meeting, various studies, various messages, various congregating, da, 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 all these various things. And to think, actually, we need to pause and go, well, maybe this is a period of time in which we're having to reflect on what is necessary, what is lasting, what is sustainable, what is true, what has depth. And I, you know, we were watching a Rowan Williams little interview earlier, and he made the point that I think is quite important here, that much of this comes down to, I think, having your own, this is a period of time in which you have your own sort of responsibility that has become quite intense because it is you and your house and so on. And so there has to be an element of how is the church facilitating that, right? That the primary place at the moment may be with the household, for example. And how do we do that? So one thing I thought, for example, is, and this was actually something our friend Victor mentioned was happening in Tasmania, I think, is that why don't we have, for example, if we're really concerned about the message, why don't we have, for example, Archbishop and the bishops just simply rotate and they provide a sermon based on the lectionary and everyone can use that. And then that frees up all that time for your local priest to then, you know, focus in on how do we bear each other's burdens, you know, in your local context, and thinking then also maybe about how do we what does it look like to, how do we prepare for after this or when we've got radical social dislocation, when people have lost their jobs, all these various things, rather than a sense of like, well, we have to keep doing much of the same.
Yeah.
You know? I still want the Eucharist to be celebrated. I want that spiritual communion, but I don't necessarily need other things, right? Yeah. I probably need more a sense of like, well, how are we thinking through this? What is it going to look like on the other side, or whatever it looks like on the other side? You know, in a context where apparently in various dioceses, multiple churches are just falling over.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, what do we do in these sorts of contexts rather than this frenetic activity towards, you know, making sure we're doing the same thing in an online version?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we are over time, and we'll go a bit more over time because there's things I want to say here. But I think there's a couple of things to say there. So one of them is it makes me think of, so I used to work for a church. I've worked for a church a couple of times and had to go along to a kind of diocese-wide professional development day, part of which was covering burnout amongst clergy. And there was a great presenter, I think it was a couple called the Condies. And you know, they were doing a great job of basically chastising the ministers there for engaging in a process of justification through busyness. And so they all kind of compete to kind of out-busy each other and to show how frenetically busy they all are kind of doing stuff. And, you know, it was both a talk looking at the kind of psychology and the psychological damage dangers of that, but it was also a call to repentance, a call to kind of repent through not accepting God's grace in that situation. I think it was absolutely right. And I think this could be an opportunity for ministers to model a kind of a countercultural slowing down at this point. But that said, Sarah and I have been attending online services through St. James King Street in Sydney, and it's been amazing too, because they continue on with, you know, a socially distanced choir and liturgy, and the priest engages in the Eucharist and all sorts of things. And we've been finding that immensely comfortable to just witness the liturgy going on, and that sense of that there is a continuity, even if we can't participate in it, that the life of the church is going on. I find that incredibly comforting at this time.
Oh, I think that's right. I don't want to be said to be saying otherwise. I think, for example, in the Church of England at the moment, where there's been a direction that ministers cannot enter their own churches in order to celebrate the Eucharist or ring the church bells. And the justification seems to be because that shows a certain solidarity with everyone else, right?
Is that coming from the state or from the church?
No, it's from the church itself.
Oh, right.
And I think that just seems very bizarre.
Yeah.
Right? I want the solidarity to know that the Eucharist is being celebrated.
Yeah, that's right. You know?
And I want that to be, I want it because I want it, right? As in I want to be part of that communion.
Mm.
But I do think there is a difference there between, you know, that and maybe this sort of, I mean, I've heard friends say that, you know, they've got their kids' program is set up, their kids have to sit down, watch the thing, and then, you know, they've got workbooks to go through and things like this. I mean, that's an extreme example maybe, but it just does point to, as you're saying, frenetic activity, where it may be the case of what we're saying is we need to slow down. And the very liturgy you're pointing to is probably an act of slowing down.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, we've gone over time. Sorry about that, but hey, come on, don't we all have this extra time?
It was kind of like a why church. It was kind of like a why church why, right?
Yeah. It was kind of like, I guess.
It was a mini cry in the shower.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you're all doing well. I know this isn't an easy time for everyone, and I hope we at least provide some distraction or something different to get angry at, perhaps. Please like us on Facebook. You can find us by searching The Eucatastrophe. Follow us on Twitter at UCAT, that's EUCAT _podcast. And also, it's been ages since we've gotten a review any podcast platforms. Our last one said that we were the Sultana brand of podcasts, and that was very funny, but we crave validation. So please drop us a review. And it does help kind of getting us a wider exposure. But thank you so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week as we talk about resurrection and the COVID-19 pandemic. I'll talk to you later. Bye.